when he, Idi Amin, confiscated all our assets and literally our family had to leave with just their shirts on their backs, that's when the family said, we need to expand out into the West.
Hi, Luke Hanson McDonald here. Welcome back to Beyond the Family Business. Today we have an interview with Adarsh Shah, CEO of Foam Co., a foam converter based in Toronto, Canada, and a member of the international Shaw business family. They have roots extending to the UK, to Kenya, to Australia, and even Papua New Guinea. So it's fair to say Adarsh is the most international guest I've had on my podcast so far. In this episode, Adarsh digs into what it's like growing up in not only a multi-generational business family, but one with multiple different industries, in multiple different geographies, with multiple different cultures. It's a whole new realm of complexity and dynamics that I have not had to face in my own business. So I think you're going to find this one really unique and interesting. Enjoy. What's your name? Where were you born? Where do you live now? And what do you do?
All right. My name is Adarsh Shah. I live in Toronto, Canada. I was born in London, England. I have two young girls, and I am the CEO of Foamco Industries and Ultramatic Canada.
Awesome. Perfect. So the question I love to ask everybody, what does family mean to you?
Well, family means for me, first and foremost, togetherness. It's about the being together with other people and having that bond with other people. Also means for me support, love, and loyalty.
Which I think a lot of time when we're talking about family business, people don't think about how even in a large family business like yours that spans the earth, that those are still the core values, you know, even at multiple generations in. So that's amazing to hear that that is what how it still resonates with you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think that even though we're really far apart globally, and I have you know family members in Nairobi in Australia, there's still this bond and this togetherness and love that you know just goes across countries,
yeah,
and oceans,
which is super cool. I feel like shows like Succession kind of only show sometimes the bad side of family business. So I love hearing that even with the complexity of your family business, you still feel that. So that's super cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did a little bit of research on your last name and sort of where it came from. And I thought it was, not to be too hokey about it, but it was interesting where Shaw, there was a number of different places it came from. But one of the earliest versions I could find was Gujarat, and it meant merchant, which super interesting given you're an entrepreneur. Another meaning, which I believe was Sanskrit, meant gentleman. And then the other meaning I found was Jain monk. Hmm. And those three things, I do think, sum you up as the person that I know quite well. Because, you know, just a quick tangent of how we met, I reached out to you because I was interested in your business. You know, I was working in a similar industry. You were very gracious. You let me come and tour your factory. And I was new in Toronto. I didn't really have many connections in the business world. And our very first meeting, you welcomed me and actually invited me to join your network of, you know, close friends and business associates. And it was right before COVID happened, which turned out to be like the biggest blessing ever. Because had I gone through that alone as a business leader versus I was immersed into the group that we have, it was a life-changing and an incredibly well-timed support system. So the, you know, merchant gentleman Jane Monk, I feel like is appropriate.
Well, ironically, you know, you're probably more of the Jane Monk, or at least I thought you were more of the Jane Monk when we first met, because
true,
you told me you'd just come back from a yoga trip in the in the Rockies somewhere,
exactly,
in British Columbia or something like that. And then you had a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet. And so I was thinking, okay, what are we getting ourselves into here, bringing this guy into our group? But it did turn out to be an amazing, a fun time to have you join our group. And
yeah,
you've brought fresh blood into everything that we do here. So.
And then we went to Vegas together, and you saw that I wasn't, you know, just a sober hippie. It was there was some fun too.
Yeah. So
you have an incredible family business story. It's by far the most international one that I will be interviewing or I've interviewed yet. So I guess could you give me, you know, sort of what is the origin story? Where did your family business begin?
So we started out in Gujarat, in outside a small city called Jamnagar, which was a small city back then. Today it's become a center for one of the biggest Indian companies in India, Reliance.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they have a massive number of businesses there.
Yeah.
We ended up making a bet on silver, and turned out to be a bad bet. We lost a lot of money, and our family said we've got to find somewhere else to move on to. And at that time, this was the early 1900s, there was a drought in India, especially in Gujarat. So our family crossed the Indian Ocean and went to Kenya, landed in Mombasa, Kenya, and began trading as merchants, as you said. And that's really the origin of how our family business started. Really, it started in East Africa.
And so what did that look like in Kenya? Like, what businesses did you grow in Kenya?
It was simple trading, you know, commodities in a small retail shop, kind of an environment.
Wow.
And we used to trade goods across the Indian Ocean on these clipper ships.
Oh, really?
Today, you know, just as a side note, when, you know, when we draft up our family constitution and we send out family communication, our logo of our family is the clipper ship.
No way.
So that's what we, you know, that's how we trace back our heritage.
I didn't know that. In the small village that I'm from, Chester, there was even a newspaper called the Chester Clipper, but clipper ships were common. I'm sure they were different design, but it was a common part of our history in that region too.
That's a great connection.
That's interesting. Good. So it started off with basic trading. It obviously grew into much more. So where did it go next? What was the first big success, I guess?
So we began, I think my grandfathers began working for somebody else when we were there. We didn't start off as entrepreneurs. We started working for somebody else, and I think we ended up buying the business from him as he began to retire. And that was the kind of the merchant and the trading business. From there, we went into tanneries. We went into plastic injection molding, and finally into corrugated steel roofing sheets. And that was, you know, what's ended up being our main business now. And in the 1970s, really was a turning point when we decided to start a steel rolling mill in Mombasa, Kenya, together with another family. So we partnered up with Marubeni, the large Japanese conglomerate, as well as another Indian family, and started a rolling mill in East Africa.
Wow.
The first one in the country.
And you were born in London, though. So how did that happen? How did the family end up in Europe?
So, and we started this rolling mill in the 70s, and the family started expanding into other countries in Africa. They had a new generation of young members coming into the family, a young men. Mostly. At that time, only men were allowed in the family business. They'd recently got educated. And so as they started entering the business, they got put into different operations. My father was sent to Nigeria to open a business. Other people went to Uganda, Tanzania, to start corrugated roofing sheet businesses, so that in a way we could give volume upstream to the rolling mill in Mombasa, Kenya. Then in the late 1970s, Idi Amin kicked out a lot of the expatriates from Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a wake-up call to our family. We'd always known Africa was politically unstable, a bit of a Wild West area. But when Idi Amin confiscated all our assets and literally our family had to leave with just their shirts on their backs, that's when the family said, we need to expand out into the West. And that's when we moved to, we started businesses in Hong Kong, in the UK, and eventually in Canada in the early 80s.
Wow. And so you were born in London.
Yeah.
And so your dad was in London for business, presumably, and then he was relocated to Canada sort of as the next expansion, or how did that work?
It was a bit complicated and really a big part of my life story, because while the strategy was to expand outside of Africa, he had to wrap things up in Nigeria. So, while I was born and growing up, he had to stay back in Nigeria. My mother came up to England and with me and my sister and basically took care of us there. She would shuttle back and forth between England and Nigeria.
Wow.
Until my dad's work was finished in the late 80s. And then the late 80s, we moved to Canada.
Wow.
As a family, all four of us.
What was Nigeria like in the late 80s?
Late 80s, it started getting messy.
Yeah.
Nigeria. I think, you know, I was there in the, you know, early 80s.
Yeah.
And it was blissful life at that time. Mm-hmm. When my father was there in the early 80s growing up, dusty, hot Nigeria, mm-hmm. Beaches, beautiful beaches, mm-hmm. parts of the country. But then Nigeria started becoming unstable.
Mm-hmm.
There were coups. At one point in time, we had to leave the country because there was a coup happening and we were crossing the border in the middle of a coup. So
wow.
Definitely would have been scary for my parents at that time.
What a massive culture shift to go from, you know, living in Africa to living in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, when I was growing up, you know, it wouldn't be, I think on a regular basis, we'd find snakes in our rooms. And, you know, I have a vivid memory of the head of a cobra cut on a piece of glass on a window outside my bedroom.
Wow. Yeah. Definitely not seeing that in Mississauga.
No.
Hopefully not.
No.
And so your dad moved to Toronto with your whole family. And then how did Foam Co. get started? Is that what immediately started when he got here? Or
him and his brother were tasked to start a business in Canada. His brother preceded him, younger brother preceded him by about a year, and they started looking for a business to buy. The younger brother had come from a little island called Papua New Guinea. That's where we'd started he'd been asked to start a business in the late 70s.
So, wow.
He'd learned how to box pour foam in Papua New Guinea, the small island off the coast of Australia. And that's what he knew. So when he came to Canada, I think that was the first thing he started looking for, a foam business. They came across a small foam business to buy. I think it was doing something like $50,000 in revenue per month. That's what they ended up buying.
Wow. Papua New Guinea. And that would have been in the 70s and 80s as well.
Yes.
Wow.
And by the way, we still own that business.
In Papua New Guinea?
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. I have to say, I'm very ignorant about what exactly is going on in the Papua New Guinea economy. So I think that's the first person I've ever met who has business there. That's incredible. So you moved to Canada. So first of all, I guess, what was that like for you? You know, you being part of this international family with both the British and the African childhood.
Yeah.
What was Canada like when you
first
got here?
That was a huge culture shock.
Yeah.
You know, I was 12 years old, I believe, when I moved to Canada.
Okay.
And, you know, you're going through all kinds of things then as an adolescent, and you're coming in with a British accent, with a very British culture, not really understanding hockey, don't know how to skate, don't know how to ski. I was very different to the rest of my class.
Yeah.
And it was a tough transition in.
And was that into Mississauga or which part of, or was it into Toronto, I presume?
Into Toronto at that time, yep. And fortunately, I got a placement at Upper Canada College, which is a great school in downtown Toronto.
Yeah.
I was, you know, entered a school where many of the kids had privilege.
Yeah.
And we were really coming into Canada at that time with really nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But education was paramount. It had always been a very core part of the family philosophy. So I was going to a good school, and I felt very grateful for that.
So what industries is your family in now? So you're, I think you've given a good sort of canvas of your, the footprint is all over the world. What are the core industries?
So we are now in steel roofing. We are in foam and furniture, and we trade. We do a little bit of trading.
Okay. And the foam and furniture, is that largely the business here, or is that also with the Papua New Guinea business as well?
The largest business is in Australia. It's also called Foamco.
Really?
And we have a Foamco here in Canada.
Oh, I can't believe I didn't know that. Interesting. It's a great name. Immediately know what you do. And is that business also similar, where it's supplying for furniture, you know, mattresses, things like that?
It is similar. It's just higher up in the supply chain. They actually pour their own foam.
Okay.
Whereas here in Canada, we're more downstream. We fabricate it, cut it, and we also retail furniture products.
Very interesting. So you have these two very different worlds that your family is in, operating in, you know, some of the safest places in the world, like Canada or the UK, and then operating in parts of the third world or second world. What is it like as far as the difference of operating businesses in those two places? I assume it's dramatically different, or the way you approach it.
Well, the geographies are different. The economies are different, for sure. And, you know, I think that one thing to note is that Africa in from the, you know, 70s and 80s and 90s even was very different than what Africa is today.
Mm-hmm.
Africa has rapidly modernized recently. So, you know, Africa is becoming closer and closer to the West today.
Mm-hmm.
That difference is narrowed.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, Africa was a Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of corruption, a lot of bribery, underspecking of material, people bypassing duties, you know, cash, all kinds of cash constraints, U.S. dollar unavailability. I remember when I was working in Africa for a while, walking around with suitcases of cash, you know, going back and forth to the bank and places, because the currency would depreciate so rapidly, and you just have wads and wads of cash.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
It's very different doing business in Africa. But in our family, you know, bringing it back to us, it's even more different, because our African business is very large compared to our non-African businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in terms of the professionalization we have in our African business, in some respects, our African business is much more professional than some of our Western businesses.
Right.
So it's a bit of a dichotomy, even though, you know, Africa is this Wild West. It's our businesses there are more structured, professional, run more professionally than a lot of our non-African businesses.
And there's a lot of optimism about Africa now as far as where things are going. You know, you hear a lot about a number of the regions, you know, including Kenya as well. They have obviously they have great national resources, but unlike, you know, places like Canada, they have an incredibly young population. And so labor is not the biggest constraint as it, you know, is in many Western countries. Is that a fair summary, or sort of how is your family viewing the outlook of, you know, and I don't want to generalize Africa as one place. It's obviously massive, but in the city or in the countries that you operate, is that fair?
The middle class in Africa is rapidly growing, and it's really a game changer right now, at least in East Africa. You know, most of my exposure today is really from Kenya, so I can speak more about Kenya than any other country, but Kenya is developing very fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's also becoming much more stable from a currency perspective, from a politics perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So in my generation, we used to see a lot of young family, young people, educated people move out of Kenya and go to the West. In the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of young people educated in the West come back to Kenya,
yeah.
building their own business, building, and it could be a manufacturing business or it could be anything else. It could be even in finance. So
incredible.
There's a lot of opportunity right now in Africa.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you talked a bit about what it's like to operate in the different locations. How about as far as synergies? So you have this very global footprint of businesses. Do the businesses work together? You know, does Foamco in Canada work with Australia? Do you still have, you know, multiple businesses in the steel roofing, you know, space, et cetera, that somehow that size is leveraged, or does everybody operate somewhat separately?
Our African businesses are all under one roof and under one name. So there is a benchmarking between businesses in Africa, a collaboration. Leaders move around from one region to another. So there is that in Africa.
Mm.
However, our other businesses work independently.
Okay.
Capital does not flow across region to region. Each region is expected to perform based on their own merit,
mm-hmm.
and raise their own funding.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, I think, pressure put on each region to kind of perform
mm-hmm.
in order to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So for the good or bad.
Yeah.
So if we, you know, one of the bads is if we see potential in any one particular region, we don't necessarily invest more globally into that region.
Mm.
Don't shift capital.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. In my family business, obviously, a lot less international. We have the same thing where, you know, our different investments do stand alone, and not that we don't try to get some synergy out of them, but they do often run as really, you know, with separate leaders, et cetera. And it's a trend I've seen a lot actually with M&A, you know, some larger private equity funds. They'll do a roll up of a bunch of companies and then they'll still keep them relatively separate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of the time, the argument that I've heard is around that accountability idea and making sure there is like true local accountability versus trying to smush everything into maybe a conglomerate. So,
absolutely. And especially in the business I work in the foam business, it's very difficult to manage two regions as disparate as Canada and Australia.
Yeah.
From a time difference perspective, distance, the one commonality is that the two countries are very similar.
Yep.
So we do have that going for us, and we are embarking on some benchmarking, but you know, we've had these businesses now for 34 years. We haven't collaborated that much.
Right.
So and I don't see that changing drastically in the future, as I see it very difficult. And I don't envision one global head of both businesses just yet.
Sure. I should have asked this actually earlier. First of all, how many people are in your family?
Yeah. So we have about 140 people in our family assembly.
Yeah.
But only a handful of them work in the operating business or in one of the councils.
Right.
It's probably less than 10.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, somewhere between 10 to 15.
Probably. Okay. Okay. Very interesting. And then, so you just mentioned, you know, you stay connected. So are you meeting up once a year? Or are you meeting up, you know, every 6 months, or what does that look like?
We do a large family assembly meeting every 2 years.
Okay.
And then we do a annual meetup on the business side of our business, where we report on our regions, and we talk about strategic matters from a business perspective for our family. The councils themselves meet every few months, perhaps every quarter.
Is there a formal family office structure? You know, is there a single person in charge or a single office or entity in charge of sort of the overall scope?
Yes. So our family business is structured with two governing councils, effectively. We have what we call the SFC, the Shaw Family Council,
mm-hmm.
and what we call the BAC, the Business Advisory Council.
Mm.
As you probably know, you know, in family businesses, you have the family side and the business side.
Mm-hmm.
So the SFC looks after the family side of the family, people,
mm-hmm.
pensions, health, togetherness, kind of some of the soft topics. the next generation. And the business, the BAC, looks after the business governance side of things. So on a global basis, they will manage the businesses globally. And who they have reporting up into them are regional boards, regional business advisory councils.
So do you report into one of these advisory councils then?
I do, yes.
Okay.
I report into a regional BAC, and then the regional BAC reports up into the global BAC.
And BAC stands for?
Business Advisory Council.
Business Advisory, okay, got it.
And each of those councils, the SFC and the BAC, or BAC, we have both family members and professional independents.
Oh,
so
smart.
We try to, you know, in the past, 10 years ago, it was just family members that would be on these councils. And I think one of the biggest changes we've had in our business, in our family business the last 10 years, is we've added a really solid professional independents.
Have you been happy about that change? Do you think it's been positive having the outside advisors?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. It helps to reduce family politics in the conversation. It's better governance, more professional conversations. You lose a little bit of the entrepreneurialism, though, that you know, from out of that. As you can imagine, with more governance, there's more hoops to jump through.
Yeah.
So we're a little bit less entrepreneurial, perhaps, but there's more harmony in the family right now.
Yeah. No, that's a great way of summarizing it. I mean, I think that's common for most businesses is when they start to add more outside leadership, whether it's at an advisory level or even at a management level, it takes some of that entrepreneur, you know, it brings in some bureaucracy sometimes, but it's a trade-off, right? And you know, as you just eloquently put it, it also, the benefit is it takes out some of that family dynamic, which can, you know, let's be honest, sometimes not be great. As well, it ensures there's maybe more transparency and you know, open decision making versus, you know, my experience is the classic, you know, founder owner can be very quick to make decisions, which is excellent from an entrepreneurial point of view. But it can also be difficult for other team members to be developing, et cetera, if you don't have that that sort of transparency. And I do find that when you have outsiders, they really help drive some more of that.
Yeah, I think that at the local level, there's a desire for entrepreneurship. You know, I think, but as you rise up the ranks, I think, and then naturally, I think with younger family members, they're more passionate, eager. I think they want to do more. But as you rise up the ranks, I think the older family members have now become a little bit less entrepreneurial, more risk averse. And that has held back our family in some ways.
Oh, very interesting. How do you find that balance between that local strategy and a global strategy? You know, is there a desire for some larger global strategy, or is it more of a just, you know, an asset management sort of approach where as long as you're making money, they're good, and then the strategies are really at a local level?
Yeah, right now, today, the structure is the latter, is what you said. The strategies are made on a local level. We're just trying to get the best return on our assets or return on equity from those individual local businesses. There is a growing desire, however, there is a growing desire from the family for a global, not a strategy, but a global vision.
Mm.
And that, I think, is critical in any family business to keep everyone together and nurture the next generation into the family business.
Mm-hmm.
Without a global vision, especially in a family business as diverse and disparate as ours, I think you lose family members from joining the family business.
And is that something that you think the next generation, you know, your generation is pushing for? Is that more aligned global vision, or is that coming from the older generations, or?
It's coming from the younger generation and perhaps from the middle generation, the intergenerational members who still want to grow the family business and want to see the next generation of family members come in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that you do need to jazz up the next generation with something that pulls everyone together.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the challenges we have in our family business is that not everyone wants to work in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, they're, we're, now the younger generation has grown up and been educated in the West.
Mm.
So we need to have a vision where we have greater expansion in the West. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to get the next generation engaged.
Mm. Very interesting. So I think it's a good, what's the word I'm looking for? Segue. From there, so you've had a global family business. You're in the, your kids are the fifth generation, right?
My kids will be fourth generation.
Fourth generation, okay. So you're in the fourth generation of a global family business with an incredible legacy, many different industries, different countries, et cetera. Obviously, you've done a lot of things right as a family to still be, you know, connected together, because it's, you know, the stats on how often families don't make it past the second generation versus, you know, let alone the fourth is pretty incredible. So what are some of the things that you've learned that have been really vital to keeping your family together over that time period?
Mm. That's a great question. I think that you have to, in our family, in any family business, not be too dictatorial. You know, family members, you can't fire family members from a family business. So you have to be able to work with these people for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And you cannot be too black and white, mm-hmm. with family members. There's a lot of listening, a lot of conversations that need to happen,
mm-hmm.
To be able to get everyone along on the same path forward. So I think that's key. I think you, in a family business, you also need to have a lot of downtime together. You need to have those moments where you bond at, over food, or over a sport, over something else, and it could be anything. But the bonding moments need to happen, and it shouldn't just be over business activities.
That's great advice.
Many of our best decisions, or most harmonious decisions, let's put it that way, have been made outside of the meeting room, in the hallways, or on during a meal,
mm-hmm.
Where there's just the commonality that develops between two people,
mm-hmm.
group of people.
Yeah, because I think the, you know, not to say something cliche, but the greatest, you know, strength and curse of a family, obviously on the curse side, as we talked about earlier, the family dynamics coming into the boardroom and stuff can be, you know, toxic, or, you know, people that are not family members can certainly not enjoy that. But the strength of it, or the gift of it, is the staying power of the family. You know, to your point about not being able to fire people, you know, in my family, my dad fired his brothers multiple times, or they quit, you know, in the early days of working together, but they're still, you know, like this.
Mm-hmm.
And that resilience of the family relationships, which in business you need unbelievable resilience and tenacity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is why so many businesses that are successful and have lasted as long as your family are family businesses. I think that makes a lot of sense.
I'll just add one thing, and I'll say, I think one thing that I value greatly, which helps to keep me going and helps to, I think, keep our whole family business together, is this respect for our elders, and just being really grateful for everything that they've done in the past. What you mentioned, you know, coming out of crisis, or the tenacity, or building up from nothing, there's a real gratefulness for that.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to always have the elders be involved in family activities and business activities, bringing them in for the cultural side of things, and making sure our staff and our employees see that generational bonding that we have, and see the respect that we have for the elders.
That is an incredibly important point. Yeah, and it, you know, whether your kids want to admit it or not, it for sure is rubbing off on them subliminally. So
I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. So why don't we stop it there for part one? And then we'll come back for part two. I'm Luke Hanson-McDonald. This was Beyond the Family Business. Please review and subscribe. Thank you very much. Talk to you next time.